As far as the aforesaid unfortunate nourishment is concerned, this can also so affect the creative ability of the individual that he or she, among other things, becomes unable to build up normal metabolic organs in his or her physical body in a new incarnation. The effect of this is that the body right from the creation of the embryo is subject to excessive obesity. The fact that such an individual is as a real born to parents with similar tendencies, or if he has destroyed his creative ability through drinking and thereby is as a real born to parents who are dependent on alcohol, or in other ways is born to parents who have the same good or bad tendencies as himself, is due quite naturally to the law of attraction and repulsion. But in order to understand this, we must go right back to the discarnated state of the individual in question, which means his spiritual existence before his present birth. In the existence mentioned, besides appearing in certain subordinate spiritual bodies, he also appears in a general or main body. This body is described in Livetsbog as the individual's body of eternity or Axtu, and is the main seat for the creative ability of the individual and is the basis for the manifestation of the individual and his ability to be reborn. This body is also the most profound eliciting factor in the individual's creation of a new physical body. Through the former body, which itself represents the seventh basic energy, the individual corresponds with the six other basic energies of existence, which means his daily life and activities, his building up and breaking down of matter, his youth and old age, his physical and spiritual existence. Since the same body thus appears as the seat for a constantly changing combination of the basic energies, it thus represents at any given time a corresponding form of radiation. This radiation can in turn be expressed as the individual's spiritual halo. This halo consists of spiritual energy. But, since spiritual energy, according to Livetsbog, comes under the term electricity, the said halo will thus be of an electrical nature of one sort or another. However, a quantity of electrical energy appearing in a particular limited form can be expressed as a wavelength. But a wavelength can in turn be directed only by attraction and repulsion. Attraction and repulsion in turn can be elicited only through apparatuses. For the spiritual or unborn being, these apparatuses consist to a certain extent of the physical bodies of incarnated beings. When a male and a female being through their physical bodies enter into a sexual connection, and this connection is perfect, which means that fertilization takes place, these beings, even if unconsciously, have attracted the spiritual halo of a discarnated individual. Through their sexual intercourse, the two beings have thus acted as a receiver for the halo or wavelength of an unborn individual. This wavelength is in turn directly secured by the receiver's condenser, which means the female being's organs of fertilization. After this connection has been made, the energy of the unborn or discarnated individual, by virtue of the above-mentioned organs, begins to vibrate in physical matter. And the result of this is what we call embryogeny, the creation of the embryo. The female being thus acts here as a direct medium or tool for a discarnated individual or spiritual being who is now materializing or creating a new physical organism for itself. When this body reaches a certain adequate position, it is separated from the physical body of the medium, by the process we call birth, after which it becomes visible on the physical plane as a newly born world citizen. For this individual, the female being is the mother and the male being the father. I naturally cannot go into the details of such a comprehensive problem here, but must refer the reader to future volumes of Livetsbog. If I here give these few vague outlines of the problem, it is merely in order to show that no innate tendencies are innocently inflicted, but that these in absolutely all cases will be identical with the results of the individual's own conduct in previous lives or existences. For, as every discarnated individual constitutes a wavelength, and the character of this wavelength consists of the habits and tendencies, the building up and destruction of the ability to create that the individual has cultivated in his immediately preceding physical incarnation, and the particular limitation of the apparatuses for its reception, the spiritual halo of the discarnated individual cannot be attracted to any apparatus, which means, a medium or parent, that is not in one way or another tuned into the same wave area. It is this divine arrangement that determines that cows cannot give birth to bear cubs, that bears cannot give birth to elephants, that elephants cannot give birth to people and so on, but that each species of living being gives birth to those individuals particularly appropriate to it. But, just as the eternal laws thus determine or guarantee the right births for the species, so too do these laws determine that the defective and the perfect individuals each get births specially suited to them, so that no tendencies, good or bad, of which they are not themselves the original source, can be inflicted on the individual through heredity. The law of attraction and repulsion determines that each individual always has the threads of his own fate in his own hands and can unceasingly work on his own deification. The most important point for this individual is to recognize his own paramount divine power in order thereby to use it in the guiding of his own fate towards the highest peaks. Chapter 10. The necessity of the transformation of the sense of taste. The individual's innate good or bad tendencies are thus not inherited from the parents but a direct inheritance from his previous existence. This inheritance is stabilized or elicited through the fact that the individual is attracted to parents within the same wave area or with the same tendencies. When the individual is born with tendencies towards being overweight, it is likewise his own inheritance from previous existences that is manifesting itself. Regaining the natural line or slimness can thus happen only by becoming accustomed to natural food. Such a process of habituation can of course not be achieved in days or weeks, but only in months or years for individuals in whom such tendencies are innate. For those individuals who suffer only from tendencies from their present life, the matter is much simpler. For both parties, however, the way to health and vigor does not go through artificial medication but on the contrary exclusively through the transforming of the erroneous sense of taste of all the individuals, so that all unnatural foods or products harmful to the organism, through this sense, give rise to a feeling of disgust, while the products that are absolutely healthy for and beneficial to the organism likewise through the sense of taste give rise to a natural feeling of pleasure and satisfaction. As an erroneous sense of taste and its ensuing unfortunate tendencies are universal, the following question is of immediate interest: how does one change this sense of taste? The answer to this is quite simple. It is, of course, through training. This training consists in getting oneself used to eating natural products, which I will here show constitute the absolutely right food for the human organism's state of vibration. When the individual has so accustomed himself to it that the taste of these products is the only appetizing thing in the world, then he is liberated from the lethal food that now, because of the force of habit, binds him like a chain to a primitive view of life, to illness, sorrow and mutilation. Chapter 11. Why vegetarian food represents less killing than animal food. Since meat or blood produce, as the reader already knows from previous sections, does not constitute the natural food for the human being, that food which must be pointed out as the right one can be found only among those substances we term vegetarian. This means that the human being's natural food can stem only from the plant kingdom. Now here objections could be made, and it could be emphasized that plants are also living beings and that their destruction or their use as food is just as much against the great commandment "Thou shalt not kill" as the use of meat is. And I must admit that this is really to some extent true. But, as the following will show, the plant beings are not so far advanced in evolution on the physical plane as the animals. This means that they do not have such a complex or sensitive nervous system as the animals, and consequently do not experience pain in the same sense as they do. As the physical area of the plant being's consciousness still constitutes merely its subconsciousness, it is no day consciousness on the physical plane, and its defining of happiness and unhappiness is felt not as realistic fact but, on the contrary, at the very most as a vague feeling of pleasantness and unpleasantness. The plant is thus, unlike the animal, not at a stage in evolution where it has a completely functioning day consciousness on the physical plane allowing the analyses of its fate, as rows of thought promoting conscious terror and anxiety, happiness and well-being, to file past its inner eye. It can therefore feel its physicality only in terms of the two definitions, a vague feeling of pleasantness and a vague feeling of unpleasantness. It has admittedly a day consciousness but, in relation to the animals, it is microscopic and, according to Livetsbog, corresponds merely to the sixth plane of existence, namely the kingdom of bliss. It is the divine atmosphere of this kingdom, converted into physical form, that gives the plant kingdom its array of glowing colors, beautiful smells and pleasant sounds. The plants are thus, according to the highest occult analyzes, spiritual beings whose descent into darkness, the material plane or the zone of the killing principle, is not yet so advanced that their shining halo of bliss has been covered by or shrouded in coarse physical material but still casts its divine enlivening radiance over the continents of the earth as well as under the waters, thereby transforming these immense deserts into gardens for everything living. As the plant being is not so far advanced in physical evolution as the animal beings and does not therefore suffer as much through killing or mutilation as they do, since the plant cannot feel anxiety or terror and cannot experience pain realistically but merely in the form of a vague feeling of unpleasantness, it will be obvious that by killing animals one creates greater suffering than by killing plants. Of two evils one must choose the lesser. And in the present case it would be the lesser evil to kill plants. By choosing vegetarian food one will thus to the least extent break the fifth commandment. This choice will furthermore result in a great advantage since vegetarian food to a certain extent can be produced entirely without killing or mutilation. The vegetable area includes in its highest examples substances that are simply designed to be absorbed as nourishment in organisms. This in turn means that these substances are in such a state in nature or are under such conditions that their absorption as nourishment in organisms means life and evolution instead of killing and mutilation. It is the emergence of these substances that will replace the killing principle on the earth and make it possible for the old saying "one being's death is another's bread" not to continue being valid on our planet. Chapter 12 The Thought Process from Below and the Thought Process from Above. In order to show the true relations between the terrestrial human being and animal and vegetable food, it will now be necessary to lead the reader through some cosmic or occult analyses. These can perhaps be somewhat difficult for the untrained researcher, but, for him or her who has the ability, energy and interest to really think them through, they will be irrefutable proof of the unshakable harmony of my book with the absolute facts or the true circumstances. It is thus not my task to demonstrate the above-mentioned sources of nourishment in the form of chemical analyses or in modern, current terms such as vitamins, calories, acids and so on. For the spreading of that form of knowledge mankind already has a whole host of competent scientists. It is likewise not my mission to write a series of new vegetarian recipe books. The world is beginning to be well supplied with these too. But while modern scientific research as well as recipe books are based on and constitute a result of the thought process from below, the information that I have to give is a result of the thought process from above and thus expresses the highest occult analysis of the above mentioned two sources of nutrition, which means the analyses of the living life itself in these sources of nutrition. By the thought process from above is to be understood the highest sensory perception or experience through the Holy Spirit where everything is perceived from the aspect of life, the thought process from below constituting merely the experience through the coarse physical senses where everything is seen only from the aspect of substance. Modern science is, for the time being, based on the latter form of sensory perception, but evolution will result in its later coming to see things from the aspect of life too, thus becoming elevated above the many illusions and pitfalls that sensory perception from the aspect of substance represents. I will now go on to demonstrate or show things from the aspect of life, thereby giving the unshakable foundation on which all science of nutrition and authorship of recipe books ought to rest. Chapter 13 Life Units. The entire universe, everything that can be sensed or perceived, is, according to the highest occult analysis, living. But all life has two aspects, namely the aspect of substance and the aspect of life. When we see something we call substance, it is really something living we are seeing from the aspect of substance. When we, however, see something we call living, it is in reality the substance we are seeing from the aspect of life. In this way, substance and life become identical, but can be felt through two fundamentally different forms of sensory perception. As the ability to feel life from the aspect of substance constitutes the most primitive form of sensory perception, it is common to all living beings at the primitive stages in evolution. The ability to sense substance from the aspect of life is, however, not fundamental until the higher steps in evolution, where the beings have gone through the great birth mentioned in Lewitzbog. For beings who do not fundamentally sense life from the aspect of life but merely from the aspect of substance, all life appears as substance or matter. This matter is in turn identical to energy, power, movement or vibration. The vibrations represent in turn an endless world of variations appearing for the senses as colors, sounds, rays, and bodies, in brief as everything we know of as created things. Since everything that can be sensed from the aspect of substance is movement or vibration, nothing from this aspect will be seen as eternal but only as changeable. Everything is therefore temporal. If one, however, senses from the aspect of life, everything becomes life for living beings. As one does not sense matter from this aspect, living beings cannot appear here in forms or bodies nor show any signs of change, since the movement or vibrations cannot be sensed here. Living beings therefore reveal themselves as eternal realities, which means that they have never begun and will never cease. As these eternal realities constitute those points from which all vibration or movement emanates, they are the only absolute fixed points in existence. These eternal fixed points constitute the foundation for everything that can be sensed from the aspect of substance, they constitute the source of all creation, they constitute the eternal living kernel in every organism and determine that these organisms achieve identity as living beings. It is such a kernel of being we have come to know through Lewitzbog as the I. For occult sensory perception, these eyes or fixed points thus become the very highest and ultimate direct analysis of everything that can be sensed. As they constitute the life itself or the living in the universe, we will call these points life units. These life units can thus through primitive sensory perception be perceived only as substance, but through the highest sensory perception this substance becomes visible as life units. A life unit thus constitutes the living being seen from the aspect of life. The life units of which one has most knowledge on Earth are of course those constituting terrestrial human beings or those to which the individuals themselves belong. Next come the animals, then the plants and after them the minerals. While the primitive or terrestrial sensory perception to some degree indirectly elicits the view of human beings, animals and plants as living beings, or as here termed, life units, it is significantly more difficult through the same sensory perception to experience the minerals as living beings or life units. These are, on the contrary, sensed more as substance, vibration or movement. But gradually, as the human being begins to be able to sense through cosmic consciousness or the Holy Spirit, it becomes more and more evident that the materials or substances mentioned also constitute life units. And it is on the basis of this evidence, which allows everything in existence to appear as life units, that one can prove that it is not animal but vegetarian products that constitute the natural food for the human being, just as it is also from the same experience that one can show that cremation, as I have shown in another book, is flagrantly against the laws of nature. Chapter 14. A list of sins far longer than that for which one asks God for forgiveness, as all substance is thus in its highest analysis life units, and our food, our flesh and blood, the air we breathe, even our skeletons, our nails and hair in reality also consist of life units, just as the material for our clothes, shoes, furniture, houses, tools and so on consist of hosts of billions of life units. One must naturally to a certain degree become acquainted with the daily life and activity, so to speak, of these life units in order, through this acquaintance, to attain absolute knowledge about the harmony of our existence with the rest of life in the world. For without knowledge of the manifestation and living conditions of these life units, we would not be able to know, for example, if the life units in the food we eat are killed or mutilated, or if they gain life and development from our contact with them. There are, as mentioned above, life units whose absorption as nourishment in organisms means natural development and life, just as there are other life units for whom the same absorption means death and mutilation. By death one must here, as elsewhere in my books, understand a destruction of the living being's body, not of its eye, for this is eternally indestructible, an absolute death being thereby impossible. People who, in the form of food and drink, consume life units for whom this consumption means unhappiness, death and mutilation, here inflict upon themselves a list of sins that, regarded numerically, is of such dimensions that the otherwise known list of sins, for which they, through religion, the church and the priest, have asked forgiveness, is nothing in relation to this. It can here be at most a matter of some hundreds of individuals in their daily surroundings against whom people in one way or another have sinned, but the number of life units they have sinned against through faulty nourishment numbers billions. It is true that in the latter case it is merely a matter of microscopic beings. But in accordance with the eternal facts, for the divine or cosmic consciousness one day for the Lord is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day, for this consciousness microcosmos is consequently equal to macrocosmos. The eternal laws are valid for small things as well as large. The fifth commandment does not state that one may kill small beings. The results of this mass murder of life units through wrong nourishment do not fail to appear. They are the cause of the fact that the whole of terrestrial mankind is not healthy, but to a great extent a collection of individuals more or less mortally wounded and mutilated by organic illnesses, who, in hospitals, clinics, and sick bays, are making their last efforts to regain the health, life and vigor that for them is a lost country. The same mankind cries to heaven about disarmament, about the abolition of war, about an eternal peace. But how can such realities be fulfilled by individuals, by units, who in themselves are active explosives against all harmony with peace as its foundation? World peace cannot be born or maintained by individuals whose very innermost selves are battlefields for mass murder, war and mutilation, constituting the concentration of all contrast to the warmth of life itself or eternal love. The individual can never come to experience a lasting peace outwardly until he has rooted this peace inwardly, in his own heart, in his own body, or in the universe in which he is himself a Godhead. When the individual reaches as far as choosing the foodstuffs for whose life units it is vitally necessary to be absorbed as nourishment in an organism, then the mass murder in his physical culture will decrease, then his illnesses will stop, then he will literally create world peace in his own breast and can look forward to the karma or fate of coming to live in an outward zone of peace. Only such individuals can send out the vibrations or energies from which a fundamental world peace can arise. Chapter 15: Why One Expresses the Life Units as Vibration, Substance or Matter. As previously mentioned, the terrestrial human being constitutes the life unit that the same being would most easily be able to investigate or observe. Let us therefore look at this life unit. We are witness to the fact that this has a physical or material body. This body constitutes its aspect of substance. It consists of many different kinds of substance or matter. This matter is in turn to be expressed as a collection of energy combinations or releases of force. In this body there is thus released digestion, oxidation, blood circulation, the development of muscle and so on, all of which are intended to sustain or maintain the body in question. Through the same body the life unit corresponds with its surroundings, which means that it exerts an influence on its fellow beings, on other forms of matter and so on. It is this unfolding of energy that we call creating. This creation thus constitutes the manifestation of the life unit, and it is this manifestation that can be expressed as the vibration of the life unit. The life unit can thus be expressed as a fixed point from which movements and vibration emanate. Just as the human being constitutes a life unit, so too does the animal constitute a life unit. The same is true of the plant. If we go further downwards in evolution, it gets more difficult to distinguish the vibrations of the individual life units from one another, and this apparently inextricable unfolding of energy or vibration is actually what we usually term substance. Since people cannot separate the vibrations of the individual life units from each other, they tend to regard these vibrations or this substance as lifeless, which means without connection to eyes. But the substance is far from being without connection to eyes, and is just as far from being lifeless. It is just as much an expression of the manifestations of the living beings as a collection of paintings, drawings, or other man-made things. There is thus absolutely no substance without life units, but where one cannot separate these from each other, one expresses their collective manifestation or appearance as substance, vibration, or matter. Chapter 16. Our happiness does not depend only on our relationship to our fellow beings, but also on our relationship to the life units or the substance in our organism. All life units, each, as mentioned above, elicit vibrations. As these vibrations vary, the life units can be divided into types according to the character of the vibration they each represent. And it is on this mutual difference in types that everything coming under the term evolutionary steps is based. Everything in existence thus constitutes vibrations. Vibrations are in turn based on life units. The life units are to be found on an endless scale of steps, since there is an endless scale of different, more or less prominent, types of vibration. The terrestrial human being thus represents one particular type of vibration on this ladder. These different vibrations are mutually dependent. This in turn means that our daily vibration, which is the same as our daily manifestation and experience of life, cannot possibly take place through our own vibration alone, but is determined exclusively by a mutual cooperation with the vibrations of the other beings in our surroundings. If this cooperation is harmonious, our life will be perfect. If it is disharmonious, our life will be mutilation and suffering. Knowledge of these life units and their vibrations, on which a life in perfection for the terrestrial human being depends, is therefore the necessary condition for reaching absolute health of mind and body. So a perfect, happy existence depends not only on good cooperation with the life units in existence that we perceive as our fellow beings, such as people, animals, and plants, but is also to the very highest degree determined by our cooperation with the life units that we do not usually regard as living beings, namely the life units that to physical sight show themselves as animal and vegetarian substances. And we will therefore, in what follows, make acquaintance with those of these life units that are for, and those that are against, the terrestrial human being in his daily journey through life. Chapter 17. The principle of life units in the universe. In order to become acquainted with these life units, we must first become acquainted with the basic principle of the life unit itself. In order to simplify access to this, I have made the attached symbol. The round figure as a whole symbolizes a living being's appearance as a life unit. The innermost white round field with the triangle signifies the eye of the same being. But an eye cannot exist or experience life except by virtue of organs or bodies, and the living being has then also, according to Levitsburg, six such general organs or bodies. Of these, only the physical body is fundamentally experienced by the terrestrial human being, while the other bodies in the individual's physical existence, which are of a spiritual nature, step into the background as subconsciousness and have their seat in the eternal body, also mentioned in Levitsburg. This entire combination of bodies is shown on the symbol as the dark ring encircling the round, white field. Within this ring we see eight circular figures that are each similar to the entire picture or main symbol. These figures signify the organs in the physical body of the individual. These organs are, according to Levitsburg, living beings and thus each constitute a life unit. The fact that there are 8 figures in the symbol is randomly chosen and does not signify the actual number of the living being's organs, since this is far greater in each living being. Look up the symbol number 7, to follow this explanation. Symbol of the principle of life units in the universe. The entire main figure on the picture signifies a life unit, that is the principle a living being.